We're really pleased to have Erin Aubrey Kaplan here today in the KPFK studio with us. She's going to talk the upcoming elections, in particular the issue of right-wing strategies for voter suppression. As many of you know, Erin is a Los Angeles journalist and columnist who's been writing about African-American political, economic, and cultural issues and the broad range of issues since 1992. She has a new book out titled Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line. Sounds good. So Erin is in the KPFK studio today. I think I've known her since 1992, which is the Urban Rebellion. Erin's been writing about political, economic, and cultural issues with a particular focus on the African-American community. She's currently a contributing editor to the op-ed section of the Los Angeles Times, and from 2005 to 2007 was a weekly op-ed columnist there, the first black weekly op-ed columnist in the paper's history, which is both a great thing and very sad. In this city, that you had to be the first. Congratulations! You know, the city's only been here forever, and but anyway, Erin, is at least it was you. That's good. She's been a staff writer and columnist for the LA Weekly, New York Times, New Times, Los Angeles. Now, she's a regular contributor. I'll tell you all the different things, but here's the important thing: her new book is titled "Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line." And as an author, everybody who's written a book wants to talk about that. So welcome back to the show, Erin. Really nice to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here, Eric. Thanks so much.
Well, let's start with even what we were talking about off the mic, which is here's the contradiction, which we'll get to. On one level, the struggle for the black community to have the right to vote has been so central to any theory of civil rights, never have been fully actualized. And then we're going to get to the second question is, given that right to vote, the significance of the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. But let's first get to the right to vote. Mm-hmm. What's happening? You and your father, Larry Aubrey, an amazing, also amazing journalist, had a workshop this weekend. Tell us about two things. What are some of the rights to vote that people need to know in Los Angeles right now? And why don't we start with that? Stuff people need to know about the right to vote.
Well, the good thing is that there are no voter suppression laws in California.
Okay,
they were sort of floated back when all this stuff was being floated about 6 years ago, and it just didn't take in California. You know, there are some good things about the state. So the procedures are pretty much the same as they've been for the last, you know, several elections. So we don't have any changes to you don't have to produce new ID or photo ID, et cetera. You show up and you vote. And so that is easy to remember. Even though we did have, at the discussion, we had the county registrar, a person from the county registrar's office come out and just assure people of that. Because there was some nervousness about just, you know, going to the polls and something new being required. Or, you know, because there's so much talk about all the voter suppression laws that are, you know, introduced or passed in 30 states. I think it's 33.
Wow, unbelievable.
It's 33 states. Basically all which happened in the last year. So even though it seems pretty quick, it's very strategized, as you probably know. But California is not part of that. So what people need to know is just remember that. But for other states, it's a whole different story. So at the discussion, which was at the Bilbrew Library, the county library on Main and El Segundo, we basically talked what was going on, about what was going on in those 30, not the entire 33 states, but the ones that really stand out, Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, and just how it all connects to a bigger strategy by corporate forces to just disenfranchise people and to stay in power. That's really what the discussion is now. One thing that came up at the discussion that was interesting was, as you mentioned, you know, 40 years ago, or 50 years ago, I guess now, it was very clear that the right to vote, it was very central to the civil rights movement. It was a moral question. People understood what the issue was, even if they didn't agree, if they didn't want blacks to vote. The issue was very clear, and the stakes were very high. Now, we have a much sort of broader agenda of voter suppression that does include black people for sure, but it's also, you know, impacting poor people, people of color, elderly people. These are the people who are easiest to sort of knock off the voter rolls.
Well, it's also the core of, for a lot of race theorists and people who, like myself, put race as central to the question.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of discussion about the changing demographics, the new majority, which will still be a very, very long time to achieve given white voting percentages.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of now, 4 years after the election of the first black president, mm-hmm. for there to be in 1 year, 33 voter suppression laws.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let's talk about how effective the right is. I mean, this is just almost unbelievable that they initiate a campaign against immigrants and they have copycat laws within 1 year.
Yeah.
Now they do a campaign on voter suppression. They get 33 bills. Tell us some of the worst state-based laws that you know about.
Well, there's Florida,
okay,
which always leads the way in things,
right.
things like this. Florida kind of actually made headlines where people started to realize that there was a bigger kind of movement going with voter suppression. When I don't know how many months it's been, and it took people a while to really wake up to this, but Florida just the Secretary of State suddenly decided there were 180,000 people whose citizenship they questioned. They never said why they questioned them. They just sent out letters to these people saying, you need to prove your citizenship. And so that's where I think it kind of came to public consciousness. And I think there was a famous example. There was one of the people affected by this was a, 75-year-old veteran of World War II or something, been voting forever and suddenly has to prove that he's eligible to vote. So the burden of proof is suddenly on these people. And what interested me was that there just was no rationale given. Why were these people suspected of not being citizens? A lot of the surnames were Spanish, as you might imagine. But again, the state didn't give any reason. Just, they got a letter in the mail saying you need to prove to us that you're eligible to vote. And so that was 180,000 people, which is more than enough to swing an election.
Absolutely.
Right? I keep remembering, I go back to 2000, much as I don't want to Bush and Gore, and the margin of victory in Florida, I remember, was 537 votes.
Wow.
And since I'm on the topic, also there was some, in my mind, voter suppression at that time. There were a lot of voters mistakenly purged from the rolls in Florida. Many of them happened to be
right.
black. So we talked about that as well at the discussion. So in Florida, of course, has the most, one of two states with the laws that ex-felons cannot vote ever. There's
right.
no coming back to it. So that's a whole other discussion, but it's connected.
Well, it's connected because the black vote is by far the most liberal, progressive left vote in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on every single question, black voters, I'm not sure on gay marriage, but seriously, on almost every other issue, black voters are far to the left on most issues. So
mm-hmm.
the destruction or the weakening of the black vote
mm-hmm.
is very serious business.
Right.
Let's switch to, since we have you in studio, I didn't know where we were going to go with this yet, but given the centrality of the black vote, how are you understanding the election, and how do you see it from the conversations that you're hearing in the black community? How significant do you think, let's not speak for the community since it's got many, many different points
sure.
of view, how significant do you think the Obama reelection is for a progressive agenda?
For a progressive agenda?
Yeah. Or for any agenda?
You
or a black agenda?
Huh. That's a good, that's a really good question. I don't think, let's take the black agenda thing first. Well, Obama doesn't have a black agenda, doesn't mean he can't have one, but there has to be, and everybody agreed to this at the meeting, this question has come up in many black meetings I've been to in the last year. Pressure has to be applied from blacks as a group, from any group, frankly. But the idea that we can sit around and expect him to help us, quote unquote, is just not politically realistic. But it is really, this idea dies very hard, that this black man in office can't help black people. It's really, the symbolism is so strong. People are reluctant to believe, or reluctant to think that Obama's doesn't have something he's going to pull out, maybe in the second term, that's going to save us, or at least help us. But, what I keep having to remind myself about is, okay, so we're not applying, we don't have an agenda that we're bringing to him that we're not making him do it, as I think Roosevelt said. To A. Philip Randolph.
Right.
But still, if you look, in the Great Recession or Depression, as I call it, what is the group that's been hardest hit? What is the group that has lost most of its middle class? What is the group that is most seriously unemployed, underemployed? It's black people. So we are Americans. And, we have to keep kind of reminding ourselves that we are a group worthy of some political attention, because there have been so many rationales given as to why that doesn't need to happen anymore. And so people, we have to kind of remind ourselves about that fact. But still, you have to apply pressure. It's all about applying political pressure. But it's also about being clear about what your agenda is. And quite frankly, a lot of black people in the community don't. Everybody has their own idea of what problems are, but there really is not. There really is not a unified agenda.
Be on Sonali Kohatkar's show Thursday at 8, and going to be part of a panel discussing the debate Wednesday night.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to act like I know what I'm talking about in the next day and a half. And so I'm trying to sort this out in many multiple levels. Mm-hmm. I mean, so the first level for me is if the very spoken and unspoken question this election is that the overwhelming majority, unfortunately, of still stable white voters do not want a black president.
Right.
Then for me, that becomes, then I'm clear on what side I'm on there. There's
sure.
one group of people don't want a black president, and the whole black community wants a black president. If that's the only thing that was on the ballot, and they were absolutely the same, mm-hmm. but the attacks on the black president were ruthless and
yes.
disgusting and totally saying, even if you're president of the United States, 35% are not clear he's born in the United States. How are you having a campaign asking about the citizenship of a president? I mean, it just shows, you know, as they say, you may be black, but I mean, you may be president and you may be a black president, but for most people, unfortunately, in the white community, you're white. You're black.
Right.
I'm sorry, I got a little confused.
No, it's true.
You know, so they have made that the issue, that you're a black president, we don't want one.
Right.
Secondly, the socialist, you know, the socialist, the radical, the third worldist, the jihadist, he's none of those.
No.
Some of those I wish he was.
If he were, he wouldn't be president.
Right?
Right.
But the constant effort to paint him into the left still means that there's a vote on whether or not you want a left president, even though he's not a left president.
Right.
So, given, to say the lesser thing, but when you listen to Romney and Ryan,
there's nothing to listen to.
This is scary, scary stuff.
Yeah.
So, to me, that's sort of issue one that I think the black community is right about, that this is a vote on the black community. What do you think of that?
Oh, Amy? Absolutely. Look, you're absolutely right. Obama's a black man under attack. We all know what that means. We all have experienced that to some degree. We've all been in that situation. So there's a deep identification with that experience.
Right.
And they can talk all day long about, it's so interesting to me how before he was elected, there was this rationale, well, he's not really black, which is why he got elected. But the moment he's elected, somehow he became black, and which is what he is anyway. But it suddenly, you know, became a very different thing once he crossed, once the party was over and he crossed the line into the White House. Then it became what we all knew it was. So I think it's been hard for, and yes, black people are going to vote for him. There's no question about that. And he has been for 4 years a black man under attack. And what he's actually done or not done is almost an entirely different question. But I will say, you have to assume, because he's done a lot of what the right wants and gone further in some cases,
yeah.
why else would he be so hated? You can only conclude that's because he's black. And there's so much, like you said, so much barely veiled code language and you know, just fierce opposition to him in a way that I haven't seen with any other politician. I haven't seen that many presidents in my life, but this seems really, really focused and furious. He's got to get out, and the whole push is to just get him out. And it doesn't matter that Romney's terrible.
That's right.
It doesn't matter that Romney's terrible and that he's craven and this and that. I mean, the Republicans have been that way for a while. But I think Republicans will line up behind Romney because their option, they don't have any other option. They are so focused on getting Obama out that they'll vote for Romney. I think.
Yeah, and the other side of it, which I do agree with, is that the Obama administration has not been good for the black community. It's been bad for the black community.
Mm-hmm.
And the Obama administration's, you know, refusal to use, it turns out $300 billion was available
mm-hmm.
to stop foreclosures and evictions that was not spent
mm-hmm.
by the Obama administration. And the number of black people have lost their homes in the last 4 years.
This is what I'm saying.
And, yeah, I agree with you, Eric.
Yeah.
That this is Aaron Aubrey we're talking to, and this is Eric Mann. We're still discussing sort of the black vote.
Mm-hmm.
First, the need to get it. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, what the community will use for it. But the fact that there's been that the black home has been for many families kept in the family for 4, 5, 6 generations, just if anybody would fail, there's always be a home to go back to. So this has been devastating.
Oh, yeah.
And will the black community as an organized force place demands on the Obama administration in the second term? I'm not that hopeful, but I'm certainly hopeful that it is. And I think the question is, who's going to raise any demands now?
The problem is, really, we feel we're not in a position to make demands. I know, you know, it's like we had this, we forgive him too much. We know, we say, okay, we need, you know, he needs to do this for us and that for us. But we understand he can't. And the reason he can't is because if he even looks in our direction, if he even expresses one bit of interest in doing anything for black people, there is hue and cry and screaming about racism and all that sort of thing. And so politically, we understand too much that it's not good for him to do that. And so but the problem is you end up with nothing. So therefore, what do we do? If we're going to, the only answer is to apply pressure and hope you respond and get him to respond to it. But even if we were to do that, there probably would be complaint that, you know, Obama or any way identifying with the black group makes him more dangerous. That's the crazy logic.
Well, the crazy logic was carried out by Valerie Jarrett, his chief advisor, who said, "Do not touch anything black."
Oh, she said that. I didn't know that.
Not publicly. She wasn't.
No,
she wasn't on the talk shows.
Right.
But she said, "Stay away from anything black because the black folks already know you're black. You don't need their vote."
Yeah.
And the minute you. Now, so if he even said, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin.
Oh, he got in trouble for that.
Yeah, that was...
He got in trouble for saying, you remember the Henry Louis Gates incident?
Yes.
Where someone asked him about the behavior of the police, and he said, I think it was stupid. Or he said it was... I think he did say it was stupid.
Right.
He got such flack for that he had to sit down in the White House garden and have a beer with a cop, which I thought was just ridiculous, and sent the absolute wrong message about the problem of police harassment. But again, if he steps into the community, he even looks like he's identifying with issues of black communities, he gets pilloried.
So speaking of pilloried, tell us about your book.
My book, Pilloried? Oh, I see. Oh, well, the book is actually, it's got a longer title than you.
Even that?
Yeah.
That's
Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line, Dispatches from a Black Journalista. So it is essentially a collection. It was published last year by UPNE Press, University Press of New England, and it's a collection essentially of my pieces, I think my better pieces over the last 20 years. Many of the longer pieces come from the LA Weekly, which is where I wrote about the Bus Riders Union.
Yep.
Some are essays from other publications. A few are columns, and some are about five or six are unpublished, brand new pieces that have, you know, not been published before. One on Obama, because it just, you know, I had to update the whole thing by speaking about Obama in some way. So that's it. That's the book.
And did you take it on tour?
Oh, not. I had an extended LA tour. I haven't really taken it anywhere else. Hopefully I'll do that. I'll get together a PR campaign.
What's the essay you like the best in the book? Because I haven't read it.
Oh.
But I.
Oh, gee, that's hard. I like all my children. Wow. I actually like, this is going to sound a little strange, the very last piece in the book is something that one of the new pieces, and it's about my husband and going through a major illness with him.
Wow.
And but somehow in a very unintended way brings together a lot of the political, social, personal issues that are throughout the book, kind of culminates in this piece at the end.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking about that. Then the last question I have for Aaron is, tell this audience about your father, Larry Aubrey.
Oh, well, yeah, I wish he could be here today.
Yes, we'll have him on.
Well, he is really a touchstone for me. He is a long time, well, first of all, he's a columnist for the LA Sentinel. He's been doing that 25 years, I think.
Right.
Although he would not call himself a journalist. He sees himself as an activist, and he does the columns are just one thing he does. He started out, he came to activism working as a consultant for the LA County Human Relations Commission back in the 60s, and he has just been involved in pretty much every community group in the black community, but also cross communities. He was... He helped form the Black Latino Roundtable. He worked with the Black Korean Alliance back in the 80s and 90s. And so he has really kind of been at the table, on so many efforts in LA to bring people together. But he is primarily interested and concerned with a black condition, which just is not is improving the way, I don't know if the way he expected, but it's been very pretty distressing for him, or for a lot of us. You know, it's been very frustrating to just figure out how to proceed from in you know at this point.
Well, you know, after the Urban Rebellion in 1992, which is when you began your journalism
right.
career, I was doing a lot of writing about criticizing Peter Ueberroth and the whole Rebuild OA and the
right.
whole private sector stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the first time I met your father, Larry Aubrey, and he came up and he said, I really like the stuff you're doing and that. So that's why, of course, I liked him, because he liked my writing. But no.
Of course.
He was, at that time in the black community, the overwhelming position was, let's get in on the action.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the Ueberroth plan for the urban plan was no social services, in fact, deregulating environmental regulations,
mm-hmm.
trying to make South L.A. theoretically more attractive to business.
Right.
And your father was one of the few voices in the black community that said, that's not our mission. Our mission is to have a social welfare state. And he continues to write for Black Commentator.
Right.
Is that right?
Oh, no, Black Commentator. He just actually writes for the Sentinel.
No, he
has he done things? Okay, maybe he knows something I don't.
All right. So we're going to take a short break. Erin, what's your last thought on the election? You have 1 minute.
Oh, I would encourage people to vote. There are people who don't believe in it, but there's just too many people who died for my right to do it. So that's my thought.
Erin, really nice to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be on, Eric. Thanks.